welcome back. As director of the MRC Star Statistics Unit, I'd like to welcome you all very much to the 8th annual Armitage Lecture. This annual series started in 2003 as a way of the unit recognising the tremendous impact of Peter Armitage's work on our field of medical statistics. We're delighted that Professor Armitage is able to be here together with his wife, Domi. We're grateful for all the support and commitment that Peter has given us, not only by valiantly attending the events over the years, but of course in allowing us to associate his name with this lecture series. I have to say, I'm also impressed by Domi's willingness to be exposed to our field. Perhaps it's stoicism, but you must be almost an accomplished statistician by now. I'm delighted to welcome Professor Odd Ireland as our lecturer for 2010. He is professor in the Department of Biostatistics within the Medical Faculty at the University of Oslo. Students of statistics, perhaps doing their master's course in survival analysis, will soon come across his name in the form of the Nelson Arlen estimator of the cumulative hazard. What they might not know is that this estimator was developed by Odd Ireland as part of his own master's thesis in 1972 at the University of Oslo. Not bad to have an estimator in your master's thesis. And it was actually independently suggested by Wayne Nelson in the context of reliability studies, and hence the name Nelson Arlen estimator. Odd Ireland went to the University of Berkeley to do his PhD, and there he introduced and pioneered the use of martingales in survival analysis. This development, from its origins in French probability theory, has had a crucial impact on the field. It allowed the elegant proof of key results about estimators used and being developed in survival analysis, as well as providing new mechanisms for assessing model fit and model criticism. Following a subsequent 5 years at the University of Tromsø, Odd Ireland returned to the south. Well, south relative to Tromsø, at least. That means he went back to Oslo, which I think is south for Norway. And during his whole career, he has made leading contributions to the fast-developing field of survival analysis in its very many different facets. And one important example is his development of the additive hazard regression model, which bears his name as an alternative or as an adjunct to the proportional hazards model of Sir David Cox. And they're not fighting yet, but... Survival analysis is an intimidating field to many, mixing both mathematical complexities with conceptual challenges. Many statisticians start to become nervous, and myself included, when one tries to consider time-dependent covariates, multi-state transition models, competing risks, joint modelling of longitudinal data and survival, recurrent event data, frailty or latent heterogeneity, and perhaps especially causal reasoning in event history analysis. In all these areas, Odd Ireland has made seminal contributions, and his recent book, published in 2008 and entitled Survival and Event History Analysis, perhaps represents a synthesis of his contributions and experience. Odd Ireland was a visiting researcher at the MRC Biostatistics Unit in 1992 to 93, as Vern mentioned, and he is a friend and scientific collaborator to a number of people in the unit. Although we have waited too long for his return, it has been excellent to have him to stay with us in the unit for this week and for him to have him speak with colleagues and PhD students about their work. So it is with great pleasure that I ask Professor Ireland to give the 8th Armitage Lecture entitled Understanding Treatment Effects, the Value of Integrating Longitudinal Data and Survival Analysis.
I'd like to thank you for this nice introduction. It's a great honor to be invited here as an Armitage lecturer. And I had very good contact with Cambridge for many years, cooperating with several people here. It's been very, very nice, very, very important for me. So it's good to come back, you know. And of course, Peter Armitage is very well known in Norway, as he is in Britain, and we still very much talk about the Armitage-Doll model, you know. I work together with people at the cancer registry, and the Armitage-Doll model is still a very important subject. So I come across this name quite often. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is understanding treatment effects, the value of integrating longitudinal data and survival analysis. And these are my collaborators in present work. And these people are participating part of this work, so I'm not, sort of not responsible for that. These are going to present it, you know. but they are participating in various parts of the work. So outline of talk, I'm going to give two motivating examples. I'll talk a little bit about lack of integration analysis of disease progression and of survival, and a little bit about time-dependent confounding using analysis of HIV core data from Swiss HIV core data as an example, and about causality and mediation. One starting point is the importance of time. Of course, in your work, it's just survival analysis. Time is present all the time. Present all the time. It's present, you know. It's a very important part of the whole setup. And you have to try to understand time. That's point of like counting process, martingales, and so on. That it's natural concept of time, you know. And time, especially, it's different from also other measurement scales because the world of fault in time and causality, of course, operates in time. And if you look at causal studies, which I'm going to talk a little bit about, you should therefore explicitly incorporate the special states of time. But time is often curiously absent. I feel in many settings. Even in causal settings and also in survival analysis quite often, you don't really take time seriously, I feel. It's important to try to understand the structure of process developing over time. And also I feel there's lack of integration of survival analysis and longitudinal data, because it's not only survival analysis that concerns us with time, but that's also the case for longitudinal data, we have repeated measurements over time. But the two fields are curiously separate, in spite of the fact that one often has data of both types in the study. If you have a typical survival study, very often you have supplementary measurements of covariates, markers, whatever, repeatedly over time and all. But it tends to be a focus. If you have survival data, it tends to be like a unique focus on the event all the time, you know, and everything else is sort of not that important. I think this is maybe not the right way in all settings. So what we shall do is to view longitudinal data, time-dependent covariates, markers as mediators of effects, as well as determinants of treatments in survival studies. I'll start by two motivating examples. These are not examples I'm going to analyze, but just as I said, motivating examples. So we start with what I have called the disappointing trials in the New England Journal of Medicine. By this I don't mean that generally disappointing trials in that journal, but there are some trials, quite a few trials there that give different results than from what you expected, you know. New England Journal of Medicine publishes a number of large clinical trials. They are often very, very large, containing based on several thousand patients. And many of them have negative unexpected results because they are still luckily published. It's a general problem in the medical literature that studies which are negative often not published, and this produces their very well-known publication bias. I think New England Journal of Medicine is an exception, you know, because the trials published there are often so large that they will publish whatever their outcome is. And the negative results may have mechanistic implications, but they are often unclear. So survival analysis is used very much in this journal. It's in fact, I think there was a paper in this journal few years ago where they sort of listed up the most important statistical methods of often they were used in this journal, and survival analysis came out on top among the slightly more advanced methods. But I think that even though they use survival analysis a lot, it's often as unhelpful as regards mechanistic understanding the way it's being used. You know. One example, treatment of aortic stenosis, was published in 2007, it doesn't say here now, but I think it was 2007. The question was whether you could prevent progression of aortic stenosis. These were asymptomatic patients. Could you prevent progression of disease into serious symptoms by giving cholesterol-lowering medication? And they gave a combination of two low cholesterol-lowering medications. It was very efficient, it really managed to lower the cholesterol quite a lot. And they compared to placebo. Actually, it turned out there was no effect on cardiac events related to aortic valve stenosis. So even though they managed to decrease the cholesterol very, very much, it didn't actually help enough. What was another feature in this study was that there was an observed an increased risk of cancer among those on active medication. This was even significant. Of course, every statistician knows that, and they also say in the paper that this could be just play of chance, because this was not the main, obviously not main hypothesis in the study. But the interesting thing is that the statistical result is in opposition to mechanistic understanding. Both types of factors here are in opposition to mechanistic understanding. Here you see the results. You see a very, very large drop in cholesterol. So no doubt that you have big, big effect here, you know. And you see the cholesterol is measured repeatedly, like every half year or so, it's measured. And when you compare these are a couple of micros for placebo versus the active treatment, you see they are almost identical. You don't see an effect at all. So what lesson can I draw from this example? Well, first of all, you can draw a lesson concerning the ability to sort of suggest a treatment that actually works, you know. Because even a good scientific understanding of disease mechanism is not sufficient to predict treatment effects with any certainty. Because mechanistic understanding of the heart is very good, you know, it's a tremendous amount of research being done on the heart, obviously. Knows very, very much. Still, the result was not as expected. And if you look at this cancer issue, enormous effort has gone into understanding how cancer arises. Still, also surprising result of the trial. This could, of course, be a play of chance, but that wasn't taken immediately for given. It's been quite a lot of discussion concerning this result, you know. So this sort of illustrates that, it's an example illustrating that the mechanistic understanding behind suggested medication is often very, very limited. Why is that so? But before I go to this issue, I'll just mention that you have all this data. These are the longitudinal data. You see the repeated measurements all the time, enough, tremendous amount of data. You see the survival data. But these are not connected in any way. They are sort of separate analysis. They are not connected in any way. And that's sort of the main point here, that maybe you should connect this type of data. That's what I'm going to talk about. But then first I'll just discuss briefly why interventions in medicine may be possibly very uncertain and unpredictable in a way. As you see from many, especially many of the trials published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So what's an intervention? I think as statisticians, we talk about interventions all the time and we analyze the effect of interventions, but we really talk about what is an intervention? What is an intervention, really, for instance, in medicine? And of course, an intervention in medicine, if you give medication, may often be the physical blocking or inhibition of a pathway. For instance, a chemical blocking receptor for adrenaline called beta blocker is a very well-known blood pressure treatment. And it's not only blood pressure treatments, but a number of other treatments are sort of found out this treatment, suggest this treatment, because they block certain pathways which are supposed to influence what you are, for instance, blood pressure. So we could say that blocking or activation of receptors is a major therapeutic principle. However, it can be quite hard to predict what happens when pathways are blocked, you know. And I think if you actually start looking at pathways, you know, if you start going into, say, the internet, going into papers in biology, start looking at the pathways which are now constructing and suggesting, you see that they are typically very, very complex. This is one example. They're often almost always very, very complex. They contain a large number of components, and it's a large number of connections between them, of course. And so the intervention consists in going in someplace in a pathway like this, and then blocking something or inhibiting something or changing something, you know. That's what you're doing. And it's quite obvious that the result of doing this is quite uncertain, you know. It's quite uncertain. Of course, you have good reason to suggest the intervention that you suggest, you know. And it's quite possible that it has maybe the effect that you intended to have, but it could have other effects as well, you know. Because if you start blocking something, it's obvious that we have things that spread out in the system, you know. So I think it's important to realize this nature of many medical interventions, that they are, we are intervening in very complex systems, and even though we have a clear understanding of the local situation, so that it makes sense to intervene there, there could still be effects spreading around, which are quite different, you know. And this is what people in basic medical research say as well. They say it's very hard to sort of control this situation. It's very hard to control the situation. And I think these papers in especially in New England Journal of Medicine, which often shows negative results, results that go in the opposite direction from what you would expect, they sort of illustrate this difficulty. Of course, there's a long process from a suggestion or certain, say, medication or certain intervention until you get this big trial that are published in, say, the New England Journal of Medicine. This is another example concerning homocysteine. It's known that elevated homocysteine is a risk factor for heart disease. And so there was a large clinical trial comprising 7,000 patients that they carried out, where they gave certain medications or vitamin B and folic acid to lower the homocysteine level. And the primary endpoint was a composite of fatal and non-fatal myocardial infarction, fatal and non-fatal stroke, and sudden death attributed to coronary heart disease. What's interesting in this case as well was that in this case, in fact, also the result was opposite of what they would expect. If they gave the combination of all these three types of medication or vitamins, they actually had a larger probability of getting the event, you know, than for instance, the placebo group. And this has been repeated in other studies. So there's no doubt that this is a real phenomenon. So it's another example showing that the result of the intervention is actually quite uncertain, even though the intervention has sort of gone all the way through a lot of preliminary studies until a large clinical trial. It may go in totally the opposite direction, what you expect. And it's interesting to look at the discussion in the editorial. There was an editorial in the same paper. And what they do discuss, for instance, is why could this happen? You know, what's possible medications? What's the possible mechanism behind this? For instance, they say that if homocysteine is an atherogenic determinant, the results of these trials suggest that vitamin therapy has other potentially adverse effects that offset its homocysteine-lowering benefit. Three mechanisms might explain the potential adverse effects of this therapy. And so they have a long discussion of possible mechanisms. It's quite interesting when they suggest that there could be potentially adverse effects that offset the positive effects. Then you can imagine that when you have these data on homocysteine repeated sometimes during the study, you could actually analyze this, you know. You could actually possibly analyze what they suggest there, you know. You could look at, say, folic acid, which has this reduces the level of homocysteine, which presumably has a positive effect of heart disease that increases the risk of heart disease. And then you can analyze the direct effect of folic acid on heart disease. You could sort of, in principle, at least statistically analyze these different effects, you know. And you could see, is it the case that an effect in this direction sort of offsets the good effect in this direction, you know? It's possible that an adverse effect which sort of offsets the positive effects here, you know. So this is something that could actually be analyzed. You can imagine that this could be analyzed from data, but it's not. This type of analysis is typically not being performed. So what I find is that there's a lack of integration of markers, time-dependent covariates, and event. I think I've said these things up here. But what's the reason why this is not done, you know? Why do you sort of stop with this ordinary, with the standard survival analysis, and then a separate analysis of the markers of time-dependent covariates? Why don't you integrate it? I think the reason is that in survival analysis, one is warned, but it's typically warned of the dangers of using internal time-dependent covariates instead of alerted to possibilities, because there are obviously dangers, obviously difficulties, and it's related to causality and so on. But I think the focus in statistics is so much on the dangers, on the difficulties, and not on the possibilities. And I think there's an attitude which is quite common in statistics that if you make like a type of causal analysis, you're supposed to say something very definitive, you know. But then you should compare this to the mechanistic knowledge, biological knowledge, and you see that this biological knowledge is not definitive at all. That's the point I was trying to make, that there's a great uncertainty in much of the biological knowledge underlying medications that are proposed. Also, I'm quite sure medications are actually used, you know. There's a great uncertainty. And so it's not natural to, on the statistical side, when you try to investigate mechanism by statistical approach, to demand full uncertainty. You should realize that even though you, if you do an analysis like this, and if you have these difficulties with internal time and covariance and so on, you might still contribute something, because you give a contribution which might be uncertain, but it sort of adds to maybe the biological knowledge, which is also quite uncertain, you know. So I think there is a sort of, there's not there's no clear relationship between the two worlds, the biological world and the statistical world, and the demands on statistical sides doesn't quite correspond to the actual situation on the biological side. Of course, it's very important that if you do a clinical trial and if you look at the main hypothesis in a clinical trial, then it should be, you should follow the established principles. But this comes in addition, you know, in addition to this, to try to understand what's actually going on. Why did you get the result you got, you know? You should try to understand more of it. It's an additional thing, you know. And that doesn't require the same level of certainty as the analysis or the main hypothesis. Okay, so you could say that if you look at the application of survival analysis then in clinical trials, you see that typically you just use the covariance at the starting point, you know, and use event. So you have baseline covariance, you have event, you do like a Cox analysis, but everything is in between is not really used, you know, it's not really integrated. There are exceptions to this, of course. For instance, people present here, I've been working on models of progression, disease progression, and so on. This is related to this issue, so there are exceptions. But I think generally this seems to be true to a large extent. I'm not only going to look at this issue, I'm going to look at a slightly extended issue, because it's a case that treatment may influence event through time-dependent covariance. That's what I was talking about now. But you have another direction as well. It's a case that time-dependent covariance may also influence the choice of treatment. For instance, it may be the case that treatment starts when a certain stage of disease has been reached. This is the issue of time-dependent confounding. In actual clinical practice, this would be the normal situation. Could we analyze treatment data from hospital registers, for instance? It's likely to be an issue that's coming more and more up, that one should not only use randomized clinical trials, but one should maybe analyze the data that are now increasingly being collected in hospitals, in hospital registries, and use maybe epidemiological methods, maybe a method from causal inference, to see whether one can learn something from about the effect of treatment. But of course, if care is not taken, time-dependent confounding may produce biased estimates of treatment effects. As the example I'm going to use is HIV, and it's data from the Swiss HIV cohort, as I mentioned. So I use CD4, which is a measure of the immune system, very commonly used in this area as an example. And then the outcome, the event, is AIDS or death. You know. This is data from collected from 1996 to 2003, which I used an example here. And so the situation I'm trying to looking at is a situation where you have an arrow going in two directions here. First of all, it's the how does the effect of treatment, for instance, how is it mediated by CD4? Could that be a direct treatment effect as well? And then how does the level of CD4 influence the start of treatment? It's well known that for people with HIV infection, you don't start treatment immediately, but you start it dependent on level of CD4 and maybe level of a number of other covariates as well, you know. So you have a situation where you have an arrow that goes in both directions. And since this arrow goes in both directions, it's not, of course, a DAG, it's not directed acyclic graph. It cannot be seen as a Bayesian network, for instance. You cannot use the methods of, say, Judd-Apatow and so on to handle the situation. You actually have to view it in time, you know, since it's sort of a feedback system. In a sense, you have to understand it in time, you know. The feedback cannot be understood without considering time. And the concept that must be used, or this natural concept to use for understanding this sort of arrow that goes in two directions, is the concept of local dependence. Local dependence is a concept for stochastic process, which is closely related to Granger causality. I just this one slide just to indicate briefly what local dependence is. Local dependence in the general sense is defined by so-called Dumier decomposition, that you have stochastic process, and then you define what you call a local characteristic that sort of determines the development locally of the process dependent on the past. So U and B are local characteristics, and these are martingales. And then local independence is defined by means of these local characteristics. So we say that Y is locally dependent on X at time T if these martingales are orthogonal, that's one requirement. And if in this case the local characteristic VT is measured with respect to the process Y of S. That is, it does not depend on the process X, you know. And this can be defined for several processes, and it can be defined in more simple manner for counting process. We have the local characteristics and intensity process. It can be defined for Markov chains, even would be a simpler definition. It can be defined for a process, discrete process over time, and so on. And so a number of contributes to this, especially Vanessa Didelet has contributed a lot to understanding this idea of local dependence over the last 2 years. So there are two issues then. One issue is how to analyze treatment effect and time-dependent confounding. That's how to handle the arrow that goes from CD4 to treatment in this case. And how to analyze mediation or treatment effects, direct and indirect effects. That's how to understand the other direction, to which extent does the treatment effect pass through a mediator like CD4 or pass through other mediators, and to which extent is a direct effect. So we sort of try to understand double arrow in the diagram. First we look at the downward part and then we look at the upward part. So the issue one is time-dependent confounding, and one good solution has been suggested for that and applied quite a lot. That's a margin structure model proposed by James and Robbins. In this case, the confounding is handled by inverse probability of treatment weighting and inverse probability of censoring weighting. This is a model that works quite well, but we should still present an alternative which we have worked on quite a lot, and this is called sequential Cox regression. And the point of this method is that it more explicitly considers the effect of the relevant time-dependent covariate. So you look more at in detail at how the relationship between treatment and time-dependent covariates and so on is developing over time. You know. While this model, MCM model, is a marginal model, so you sort of don't look at the details in the development in the same way. And in this case, we only need inverse probability of censoring weighting, not inverse probability of treatment weighting. And this is, in fact, much simpler to handle. This inverse probability of censoring weighting is much easier to handle than the inverse probability of treatment weighting, which is a more complex issue and also less stable in some settings. So as I said, I'm going to use the Swiss cohort data. This is an ongoing multi-center research project following up HIV-infected individuals age 16 or older. Goes from 1996 to 2003, the data we have. And in addition to CD4 count, we are looking at HIV-1 RNA, which is the measure of the amount of virus in the blood. And there's a large number of other covariates and variables included as well. And the endpoint of interest is AIDS or death. And there were 78,000 person months of observation, 2,161 individuals for a third or minimum one and maximum 92 months. And this data set has already been analyzed using modern social models by Rastein and co-authors in 2005. So what's the idea of the sequential Cox approach? The idea is to mimic a sequence of randomized clinical trials based on each time period, which is practice one each month, or treatment starts. We look at each month from the start, from sort of the start of the cohort, and then we look at which individuals start on treatment during that month and which individuals have not yet started on treatment. So we get the number of sort of mimicked randomized trials, one for each month, so we get a large number of such trials. And what we are doing is to average of all mimicked randomized controlled trials to find an overall effect estimated by composite likelihood. So we sort of combine the effect from all single months by composite likelihood approach. We consider only individuals starting treatment in a certain time interval as the treatment group. And analysis start at the starting point of this individual, of this interval. Individuals still not on treatment in this interval serve as the control group. If they start treatment on the later stage, they get censored. This is quite an important aspect that if individuals start treatment later, they get censored. This is called artificial censoring. Censoring was suggested by Miguel Hernan in a different context. So individuals function as controls until they start treatment, where they are censored. They may be censored for other reasons as well. And you could have dependent censoring, and we handle that by inverse probability of censoring weighting. We adjust for covariates at baseline at the start of the mimicked randomized trial using for instance a Cox model. We practice use a Cox model. So these are just two time intervals. You have a large number of time intervals like this, but you look at those who start on treatment that time interval, and then you have the controls, that's the people who are not yet on treatment. And the situation is such that if one has started treatment, then one's regarded as being on treatment. We don't consider the possibility of going out of treatment again. If you start treatment, then you are in the treatment group. And controls get removed for censoring reasons, so they get removed as controls because they start treatment, you know. So they get continuously removed here. So we have sort of a number of mimic clinical trials over a large number of intervals. And this artificial censoring is an important thing. And what's the causal interpretation of artificial censoring? By assuming no unmeasured confounders, you can make an analysis by direct acyclic graph of this causal effect. It means that if a person has started on treatment and then there's a new treatment coming in next period, or if the person has not started on treatment but started the treatment next period, then you censor the individual. And by doing that, you block the path from treatment in the first period, treatment in the second period, until the event you're looking at. So you block this path. And then by analyzing this, you can also see that by conditioning on L1, these are time-dependent covariates, L1 and L2 in different intervals. By conditioning on L1, which is the start, just at the starting point of this specific mimicked randomized trial, you block the backdoor effects. So you can argue by using these sort of arguments, you can argue that this will have a correct causal interpretation given that there are no unmeasured confounders. Of course, there are a lot of, and this L1 contains a lot of confounders which are measured at the start of this particular treatment period. So these are just for the two first periods, but this repeats itself over and over in all the individual periods throughout the study. Okay, when we carry out this analysis, then this is the result of the modern structural model. It shows a treatment effect of 0.014 sequential Cox monster treatment of 0.176 when they do not correct for possible dependent censoring. If they do correct for possible dependent censoring, then we get the treatment effect of 0.165. So it's quite similar, but it cannot be interpreted as meaning exactly the same thing. It does not have exactly the same interpretation as a margin instruction model, but it's quite similar, and you see you get quite similar results. And those results are quite different from what you do if you, for instance, use an animated Cox model with baseline time-dependent covariates, then you get quite wrong result, which is precisely due to the treatment confounding, time-dependent confounding of treatment. Or if you use a Cox model with just baseline covariates, you also get a completely wrong result. You know, so you see that this confounding is a serious issue, which has been pointed out by James Robbins, by Miguel Hernan, and other also in this field. They have shown that repeatedly, and they get a much more correct result by using the model instruction model. And we use a different approach and get results that are quite similar. What should be the advantage of using this particular approach? One advantage is that we, if you do a margin instruction model analysis, then you use baseline covariates. You use the covariates sort of at the starting point of the study. But we can use baseline. We can use covariates at the starting point of each interval. You know, whenever a new group starts on treatment, we can use the covariates which you have at the beginning of this interval repeatedly. And this means that we can, for instance, look at questions like which levels of CD4, for instance, are best, or at which levels of CD4 should, for instance, treatment start? You know, you could look at these kind of situations. You can compare different levels of treatment start, different levels of CD4 corresponding to whether you should start treatment or not, and look at the hazard ratio you get. So you get more detailed information. So this is an example of integration of time-dependent covariates, namely CD4, and the issue of treatment and of the result which is developed, you know. Just your comments to the sequential Cox approach. The fact that we control for covariates at treatment start opens up for some additional possibilities compared to fitting MSMs, that's what I already mentioned. And inverse probability treatment weighting is avoided, which increases stability because this is sometimes unstable. Both the margin structural model and sequential Cox regression model can be seen as a way to model the situation of a randomized clinical trial. And we feel that ours is an intuitive and literal way of doing this. And there's also an additional causal assumption. Since we look at the number of individual time intervals, we have to assume that the treatment effect is the same in every trial. Or alternatively, you can sort of view it as an average treatment effect, you know, over the whole time period. You could also divide the time period into parts, you know, and look at maybe the first year, second year, and so on. But we have not done that here. So now this is the first issue, and then the second issue is mediation. So now we are looking at the other direction of the arrow, namely when the direction from treatment through possibly CD4, we're actually going to look at the amount of virus, the viral load, to the event. So in general, when attempting to understand causal mechanisms, there seem to be two issues that seem to be quite important, you know. You should look at time direction. It's obvious that the past influences the present and the future. So you should actually explicitly consider it. You should actually clearly look at the past, then you should look at what happens present and what might happen in the future. This is a dynamic point of view. There's another important thing when you consider causality and time. Namely, that's what you could call locality. That effects are transmitted continuously at time. You sort of imagine that if there's a mechanism operating, then it sort of operates continuously in time. And if you want to try to understand a mechanism, then you have to sort of divide time into small intervals and look at it as continuously as possible. And this means that the stochastic process intensities or local characteristics are relevant. I've already mentioned this connection to connected to concepts like martingales, the mere decomposition counting process, and so on. And local dependence is again highly relevant in this case. Because this process and these like martingales and so on, they explicitly consider this time dynamics. And in fact, this concept of a directed acyclic graph or a Bayesian network actually comes in here as well, but it comes in a slightly different way, you know. You say if the observation is made continuously, then the standard DAGs are not relevant. Instead, the outcome should be a differential or derivative in continuous time, or it should maybe be an increment. If you look at this time discrete, it should be an increment. Analysis done by the additive Hassel model. In discrete time, as I mentioned, the analogy is to focus on increments as outcomes. And the importance of this has been stressed, for instance, by Daniel Fairwell, by Diggle, Fairwell, and Henderson, 2006 and 2007. So what we are doing is to, in a sense, what we are doing is to make a DAG for every, like if we consider a counting process, I look at events in the counting process, we are considering a DAG whenever an event occurs, you know. So this is a jump in the counting process, and then you are considering, like you have a treatment effect, you have time-dependent covariates, you might have other covariates, you might have unmeasured confounders, you are sort of making a DAG for each at each specific jump time, you know, each specific jump time. And then you have to use a method that we could actually do an analysis at each specific jump time. So we are actually doing a linear or additive regression analysis for each node in the graph at each specific time when an event occurs, conditioning on parents and baseline covariates. Okay, I'm going to explain a little bit more how we do that, but I'll give you a couple of examples of what I'm going to look at. First, I just look at what we call RNA is simply the viral load, you know. It's a measure of the viral load. What's it for? It's a measure of the level of the immune system, how the immune systems works. And so the first thing is just to analyze these time-dependent covariates, you know, not using event at all, but just using the time covariates. And this is then a DAG. We look at the previous value, look at the last measured value, and then you see how it influenced the increment. So you can imagine that the viral load would influence the change in the same measurement, but it might also influence the change in the CD4. Like CD4 might influence the change in viral load and the change in the CD4. And then, when I looked at this issue separately, we can then look at the issue of event, you know, actually observed event, and you have the treatment. And then you can imagine that the treatment, how it has in fact passed through the viral load. We actually focus on the viral load here because it turns out to be much more important than the CD4. And the treatment also, I may have direct effect, may have other type effect, go through something else, you know, on as effect on event. In this analysis, we also have numerous confounders that are corrected for. So this is the first analysis. You do not look at the event, you just look at the viral load and the CD4, and you get a quite clear result. You find that the viral load at previous time strongly influenced the CD4 increment, while the CD4 increment at previous time does not influence the change in viral load. This is exactly what you should expect, you know, because the way they understand the effect of treatment, that the treatment influences the amount of virus in the blood, and then there is a change in the CD4 after that, you know. So this gives a very clear direction for how this works, and corresponds precisely to the sort of biological understanding. When you look at the model for events, you should use an additive model, and the additive has a model sort of satisfy this issue of time locality, because you can actually do an analysis, you can actually do a regression analysis at each event, time, when just one single event happens, you can actually estimate the effect of the covariates. Of course, these estimates at single time do not make sense in itself, but when you combine them many times, you get something that is quite reasonable. And additive model is based on taking the hazard rate and writing it as a linear combination of a number of, in this case, time-dependent covariates. The results of this analysis is as follows. Actually, these results are presented as cumulative effects. So you can see initially there is mainly an indirect effect. So we are looking now at to which extent does the effect of treatment, of the heart treatment, go through the viral load, and to which extent could it take another direction. And if you look at the first few years, you see that the direct effect, which then is the effect going in other directions, is very slight to begin with. And the main effect is definitely going through the effect on the treatment on the amount of virus in the blood. But later on this changes, you get direct effect, which is much larger. And this seems to indicate that there could be an effect after a while, which it does not only concern viral load, you know, which has another direction. And this, in fact, is confirmed by the literature. There is several papers in the literature indicating that the effect of the heart treatment is not only an effect going through viral load, but it also has a number of other effects, number of other positive effects. So at least it's quite reasonable. Of course, when you talk about direct effect, it doesn't mean it's a real direct effect. It just means that it doesn't go through the measurements or the time-dependent covariates that actually are included in the analysis. It's very important to be aware that these estimates of direct and indirect effects are not definitive statements, but they are useful tools. I go back to the original examples I showed, where I pointed out that if you could contribute maybe some knowledge based on statistical analysis, this could be quite useful, even though they are not final, definitive causal statements. The analysis I presented here very briefly is related to standard path analysis. But the point is that you do analysis over time. You follow it very detailed over time, because you can do an analysis whenever there is one single event or one single increment in the covariate process. You can do an analysis, so you get a much more detailed picture of what's going on than doing standard path analysis. But otherwise, you can do all the things you do with standard path analysis. You can sort of multiply, for instance, the path effects along the path. So you can sort of use many tools you do in standard path analysis. Of course, if you look at it from more causal point of view, it's well known that such mediator analysis is due to can be disturbed by confounders. For instance, a typical objection is that there might be a confounder between mediator and the event, you know, which means that the analysis then would not have a causal, be causally correct, not have a causal correct conclusion. So you have to sort of assume that this kind of confounding is not present, at least in a simple type analysis, you have to assume that you don't have this type of confounding present. So what's the relationship generally to causality? Well, causality will always be uncertain, and this is emphasized strongly in the course literature. For instance, there's a paper by Colin and Al, 2002, where they point out all the difficulties of doing mediation analysis. For as I said, mediation starts out typically tentative. We do causal exploration, but no definitive confirmatory statements. But on the other hand, this kind of analysis has been now been also viewed from a more precise counterfactual causal point of view. There are two papers coming which have been submitted now. For instance, a paper by Martinussen, von Steland, Geister, and Jellenborg, estimation of direct effects also for survival data. Another paper by Lange and Hansen, direct and indirect effects in survival context, which use these type of methods. And they connect it in a much more precise manner to the counterfactual definitions of direct and indirect effect and so on. They still have looked at relatively simple versions of this, not the full versions. We'll see that how the effects change over time. But there's a development going on in trying to understand this in a much more detailed way. Then at the end now, I just want to make a couple of comments on the counterfactual definition of mediation and causal inference. Because if you read the causal inference literature and try to understand how do they define this, if you really want to define it in a precise way, then this is based on the idea that the mediator can be physically manipulated to a given level or distribution for both treatment levels. And this is the main focus is on the estimation direct effect. It turns out it's most easy to define direct effect. And so the idea is that you have two treatment levels, and then you can physically manipulate the mediator to have a same level for both treatments. And this can be done in different ways. It can be done by so-called controlled treatment effect or by a sort of controlled direct effect, or as a natural direct effect. And there's a couple of statements here. For instance, Pearl, he says that requirement of holding the mediator variable fixed must be interpreted as hypothetically setting these variables to constant by physical intervention, not by analytical means such as selection, conditioning, or adjustment. And a quote from Vanessa Didelet, we need to think of a way of intervening in X, which is the mediator, changing it around while C, no, intervening in the treatment, changing it around, while C can still be generated as if X was kept at its baseline value. So X is treatment and C is the mediator. For natural direct effect to be empirically meaningful, it needs to be made clear how such intervention can be carried out in practice. And this, I think, is an important issue, because I think if you really go into how mediation, direct and indirect effects, should be understood in a precise, counterfactual way, then what you meet is this requirement of being able to manipulate it in principle, you know. It also has to be, you have to understand this to some extent, how it can be done in practice, as Vanessa Didelet says here. And she has one example which is very reasonable, you know. See that this can sort of be done in some cases. For instance, he says that an example is a clinical trial using placebos. Here, every subject receives a tablet, so that psychological effect of thinking that one is being treated is the same, while some subjects receive an active ingredient and others don't. This study design allows to estimate the direct chemical biological effect of the active ingredient, not mediated by any psychological effect. And this is sort of an example where you can do this kind of manipulation. But I think in many cases you can't really quite imagine how to do it, you know. For instance, if you go back to the heart treatment for HIV, then if you should imagine a counterfactual definition of direct and indirect effects, then you should be able to sort of manipulate the situation so that whether you got the treatment or not, you could keep the amount of virus, the viral load, on the same level. And this does not sound reasonable, you know. And if you look at the literature, that is not what they are attempting to do. But what they are attempting to do is to, for instance, apply heart treatment to people who do not have HIV. Say people who have cancer but do not have HIV, they give them the heart treatment, and it has a good effect anyway, you know. And this gives information that the heart treatment probably has an effect that comes in addition to the effect on the viral load, but it does not follow the definition, the counterfactual definition of mediation, direct indirect effects, you know. So it's a more circumstantial type of evidence. And I think if you look into the biological literature, then you find that the concept of mediator is very, very important. There's a very, very large role. If you search in the journal Nature, you find several thousand references to mediator, you know. But you see that this mediator concept is something different from what you find in the causal literature. It's something where you collect information or evidence in a much more circumstantial way. You know, it's a much more circumstantial evidence. It's not doesn't fit directly into the definition, simple manipulation definition. So I think that when you look at the concept of mediator in biology, it actually has to do with defining pathways, you know, because you have this large pathway system. They are just representation of mediators, the sort of directions and ways that the effect take, you know. So you can say that effects can take various paths, maybe true in the physical sense. It may not depend on some perceived ability to keep a mediator constant. Certainly the underlying biological structure with its causality and mechanism does not depend on human intervention. So I think human intervention is not really essential for such a definition. And there's citation from Glennon, 2002. He said that causal mechanical explanation exemplifies what Salmon calls the anti-conception of explanation. Explanations are not arguments, but are rather descriptions of features of mind-independent reality, the causal structure of the world. So mediators exist or do not exist, whether you can intervene or not intervene. So I think statisticians do not really have, I feel a good hold on precise causal definitions of direct, indirect effect and mediation. The summary, a causal exploration is a tentative affair combining biological and statistical inputs, and the unique focus on the event and survival analysis is unfortunate. Integration with markers and progress data is necessary in order to get a picture of the development and some insights into the mechanism. And I think that mechanistic knowledge in medicine is far more limited than maybe generally appreciated, and certainly that the help of statisticians is needed to find out more about this. Okay, thank you very much.
Wide-ranging talk, some conceptual, some mathematical, some challenges to statisticians, and we thank you for that. There is an opportunity for questions and comments if people would like to make some. Abdul Babka.
Trying to address time-dependent confounding either by inverse probability weighting, treatment weighting, or by sequential costs. In the example, I think you got slightly different estimate for the effect of Haas by the two method. Yeah. I mean, do you have any idea why they're different? And the other thing I was going to say is just a comment. The reason why the joint analysis is not being done is because although marginal structural models using inverse probability weighting or treatment weighting does correct quite a lot for the selection bias for those who are being treated, they depend on a very strong assumption, because these probabilities are estimated from the data itself, and they're estimated from some covariates available in the data to estimate the probability. And so there is an assumption that we have got all the confounders. There are bound to be lots of other unmeasured confounders which are not done there. So it's not really a panacea for everything.
No, it's true. Of course, that's an assumption of unmeasured confounders, you know, that's true. I still think that these types of causal analysis, like the margin structural models, are very useful methods, you know. But when it concerns the relationship between the sequential Cox regression model and the margin structural model, it's natural that they don't give exactly the same result, you know, because they're different methods. In sequential Cox regression analysis, we look at each time interval and then we do a separate comparison. We sort of start up a number of clinical trials in each interval and follow them over time. and we adjust for everything that's known at the beginning of this particular interval, you know, then integrate everything together composite likelihood, by composite likelihood method, you know. And this is something different from the marginal structural model. The marginal structural model is defined in a different way, you know. It uses inverse probability of treatment weighting. It's a marginal analysis, you know. It is not correct for what's known at precisely treatment start, while we correct what's known at precisely at treatment start. So it's two different methods, you know. But still, I feel that they're quite similar because both of them really intend to look at, sort of compare as directly as possible those who are treated and those who are controls, you know. So they should give quite similar results, but there's no reason why they should give identical results, you know.
But there's a lot in common between them because the bias is corrected in the sequential Cox by inverse weighting the probability of censoring. That is when people are, you know, selected people are given treatment. I mean, a common example in not just in HIV is that people who are likely to be treated are people who sort of, you know, health-seeking behavior. They tend to be of high, maybe social, more educated. They probably tend to live longer anyway. Hmm. And unfortunately, these very important cofactors are not measured in observational studies.
That's right. But that's been pointed out by Miguel Hernán and Robbins, is that when they do this marginal structural model analysis, they get results are quite similar to what they get in actual clinical trials. But today you can't do new clinical trials of heart treatment. It's not ethical to do that. But if they compare to the old trials, they get quite similar results, you know. So I think, and you see that, you saw the results were very different from doing naive Cox analysis. I mean, very, very different. Naive Cox analysis would be very, very wrong. So I think it's a good principle, you know. I think it's a good principle. And I think it's a very good idea. And I think we can also look at alternatives, as we have been doing. You know, we have an alternative which gives somewhat more precise information about concerning the special situation at the starting or treatment, whenever they start, you know, you use the information at the start of treatment. So especially you could ask questions, okay, when should we start treatment, you know, then I think maybe the approach could give more information about this.
Other comments, questions? Fern Fowler?
Yeah. I was struck by your comment saying that the usual advice with survival analysis is that you have to be very careful using internal time-dependent covariates.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of advice that was given to me by a fellow of the Royal Photographic Society who said, you know, how do you take impressive pictures? He said, well, you ignore all the instructions which are inside the film box. In the days of film, that was a long time ago. In the same sense, how these ideas are, I think they're tremendously important, but it is, how are we going to get them established early enough that they can be, you know, sort of they're received more receptively through teaching or early.
Yeah, I think this is up to the statisticians, because I think if you look at all these clinical trials, I mean, like maybe thousands of trials every year, survival trials, where they collect a lot of information, and where they do just ordinary survival analysis, and then they do some graphs of the things that are measured. But it's never integrated, and they never got this knowledge. I think a lot may be lost, you know. And if you look at this, one of these treatments where actually the treatment actually more or less killed people, you know, you could say that a lot of people have sort of sacrificed their lives. Maybe you should learn something more from it, at least. I mean, so we can get some minimal knowledge. So I think there's a lot of potential. I think it's very unfortunate that this information is not used. I think it's the statisticians that are sort of given the impression that this shouldn't be done, you know, it can't be done. And so we have to tell them that this could also be done as a supplementary analysis. But it's very important that it's a supplementary analysis, because it doesn't have to have a randomized study. It doesn't make this analysis any more sure, any more certain anyway. It still has problems, you know. The randomization doesn't guarantee anything. So we have to... It's very important to divide very clearly between the randomized clinical trial that should be analyzed by the standard methods, and then supplementary analysis where you try to understand what's actually going on, you know. And some of these studies, you follow people for maybe 10 years, you learn a lot, you know. Why shouldn't you try to understand what you have?
Thank you. Short thing.
Oh, just following on from Abdul's earlier question, I was wondering whether the sequential Cox method and the marginal structural models would give exactly the same answers in the situation where you've just got categorical variables and saturated models.
Mm. That's possible. I can't really see through this, you know, whether this is true or not. So I can't really answer now. So maybe one would have to look at the details of that.
Okay. Thank you.
A last question or comment? Sheila.
Odd, in the original Concord trial, one of the problems was that the control group, whose CD4 counts, of course, were deteriorating to a greater extent than those who were receiving acetazolamide, they were given treatment for pneumocystic pneumonia and so on, because at an earlier stage than those who received cytobutine. And I wonder if in the mimicked randomized trials, that censoring mechanism that you were talking about might actually, in that particular case, give you an over-optimistic impression of the primary treatment, because you're not allowing yourself to see the benefits of an alternative approach to dealing with deterioration, which actually in clinical practice happens for the control group.
I think that this is a very simple case, you know, which I've been studying, and you know, it's a sort of the simplest situation, you know, you can look at. And I certainly the case if you have more complexities, it wouldn't be covered by this kind of analysis. But my idea is that you could maybe make more elaborate models. Maybe you could get more understanding from that. You know, I think you could, you know, without knowing the details of the case I'm describing, I think you could make more elaborate models. I think there's potential for understanding more. In fact, mediation models have been used in other fields, you know, been used like a lot in psychiatry, for instance, psychology, and has been heavily criticized as well, you know, past analysis mediation models have been heavily criticized. But maybe the criticism has maybe been a bit too strong. I don't really know, but in survival analysis, it's strange because in that field you don't find this mediation analysis, you know. And survival analysis is often used in a setting where you have biological knowledge, like in psychiatry and psychology and sociology. You don't have this biological knowledge, you know. You don't have a real understanding of the phenomenon you are discussing, but here you have all this biological knowledge which could be integrated. And I think it's potential for then the statisticians also to contribute to mechanistic understanding is better, you know, in this area, in the biological area. So I'm convinced that at least quite a lot could be done this direction.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we've heard a fantastic repertoire of both conceptual and technical ideas here. I would like you to not only note that Norway is a very beautiful country, slightly more hilly than Cambridgeshire, and to thank Odd Arlen very much for giving this lecture today. Thank you.